somebody, help. Not just anybody, help. You know I need someone, help. When I was younger, so much younger than today, I never needed anybody's help in any way.
Again, my friends, to the Ask Beanie Show. And for those of you who've been listening, it's now over 10 years. It's absolutely amazing how quickly the time has gone. And for new listeners, I am a psychotherapist, yes, one of those, and a sex therapist. I'm also the author of the groundbreaking book on relationships, For Better, For Worse, Forever, Discover the Path to Lasting Love. And I know I say this every single week, but it's certainly a book that I wish I had had when I began my own relationship life so many years ago. In fact, people ask me, so what is your book really all about? Well, I did research with 450 people in the Boston, Providence, and Connecticut area, and I developed a formula. And for people who know me, you know that I'm very bottom line. And if it doesn't work, let's not waste our time talking about it. But what this formula actually does is that it teaches us exactly how to assess. And I know that the word assess is not sexy, it's not romantic, but it's absolutely critical. So it teaches us how to assess who is right for you and who is wrong for you before committing to any serious relationship. And, you know, when I cite the divorce statistics every single week, it's very, very clear that more and more people clearly need to read the book, because we're looking at a divorce rate for first marriages of 48%. And one would hope, right, when we go into a second relationship, a second marriage, a third marriage, that we would find ourselves in a better place. However, the divorce rate for second marriages is 67%. And for third marriages, and I know that people are really, really shocked and surprised to hear that the number for third marriages, the divorce rate for third marriages, is 72%. So we really haven't learned much about relationships, right? We're looking at domestic violence statistics that are just really, they're over the top. And this is not about blaming anybody at all, but it's about, are we willing to learn? And I often talk about in my therapy sessions with patients. I have a private practice here in New York City and also in East Hampton. So one of the phrases that I routinely use is lessons to be learned. You know, what are we actually learning about our mental health, about relationships, about sexuality, about physical health, about nutrition? Because there are more and more podcasts and shows and self-help books and therapists, and yet we are not seeing positive changes at all when it comes to so many areas of our life. And, you know, one of the things, I was having this little talk with my husband, Jim, before the show just a few minutes ago, and I was asking him, what do you think the impact of my show has been on all the thousands of people who have tuned in over all of these years? Because we've talked so much about finding therapists, we've talked about toxic relationships, we've talked about healthy relationships and how to put the sizzle in your sex life. And the topics have gone on and on and on. And yet I wonder, and this would be such a great opportunity for us to find a way, perhaps, whether it would be on Zoom, ideally in person, to be able to build a kind of a community where we could meet each other, where we could talk with each other, where we could discuss, where we could debate the issues that I deal with here on the Ask Beattie Show every single week. And another thing that I was asking Jim was that, you know, I wonder over all these years, you know, I've been talking about the importance of not needing to navigate the ups and downs in our lives, in all of our lives. Believe me, whether or not you're rich or poor or black or white or gay or trans or Jewish or Christian or Muslim, trust me, over 35 years, I have treated thousands and thousands of people from every walk of life. And all I can tell you is that we all have our issues. And yet it's so important that we really give ourselves permission that we don't need to navigate the rocky terrain that we all need to deal with, you know, on our own. And that's something else I wonder. I mean, for example, there was a huge, huge story in the New York Magazine this Sunday, and almost the entire magazine was about therapy. And the cover story, in fact, I'm looking at the cover right now. Should you be in therapy? Isn't everybody else? And I wonder, so again, I wonder that therapy now has become much more normalized than it was in previous generations. I know that when I was a child growing up in Winnipeg, Canada, nobody talked about mental health issues. Nobody talked about therapy. I think that there was an assumption, of course, a false assumption, that if you were really sick, if you really had mental issues, in quotes, that you might need to go and see a psychiatrist. It was not she at all. There was a real negative stigma that was attached to mental health problems. And yet I look at the mental health statistics every single, actually, you know, every few days. And what we're seeing is that depression among adults in the United States tripled. It tripled in the early 2020 months of the virus, okay, jumping from 8.5% before the pandemic to a staggering 27.8%. So this is equivalent to over 50 million Americans. But what's really interesting is that new research from Boston University School of Public Health reveals that the elevated rate of depression, it has persisted. You would have hoped, you would have expected, you would have dreamed that those numbers would go down since the pandemic has basically passed and that we are supposedly, you know, connecting in more normalized ways. But what we're seeing is that this rate has climbed to 32.8%. So, and how that translates, my friends, is it affects one in every three American adults, and almost a third of all adults with a mental illness reported. And this is another thing that really needs to be talked about, is that they reported that they were not able to receive the mental health treatment that they needed because they could not afford it. So as I was reading the New York Magazine yesterday and today, because there are pages and pages and pages talking about a variety of different mental health issues and practitioners and modalities and methodologies. But the fact is that if you are not lucky enough and fortunate enough to be able to have insurance or to be able to have the out-of-pocket expenses, you are going to have a really, really difficult time getting the help that you need. But having said that, and this is something that I have always done in my practice, is that if you are starting to work with somebody, do not be afraid or ashamed or embarrassed or reluctant to talk about a sliding policy, a sliding scale policy. And I think it speaks volumes about therapists who are not willing to give patients a break. And I know here in New York, I mean, the rates for therapy are absolutely astronomical. I mean, there are people who are charging $350, that's $350 for 45 minutes, for 50 minutes. I know that there's a psychiatrist here in New York City that had come very highly recommended to me because I have patients who actually need to see a psychiatrist for much needed medication. But the fee was $1,000. It was $1,000, and my patients were not able to afford to pay $1,000. And I actually suggested to both of these women, I said, why don't you ask him if there is a sliding scale, if there is a payment plan? And this particular doctor was reluctant to change his fee schedule. But again, I think that speaks volumes about the person's character. And would you actually, when you think about it, would you actually want to be working with somebody who is so bound up in the bottom line that they were not willing, to reduce the fee or find a way for you to be able to receive your much needed therapy? And again, we talk about therapy, we talk about mental health, and yet I look at the suicide statistics. It's the 12th leading cause of death in the United States. Every single day, 130 Americans die by suicide. Suicide rates for women are highest amongst those aged 45 to 54. And you may not be surprised by this statistic, but females attempt suicide 3 times as often as males. And in the LGBTQ community, lesbian, gay, and bisexual children are 3 times more likely than straight children to attempt suicide at some point in their lives. And what about middle-aged white men? Well, suicide rates for males are highest, actually, among middle-aged white men. So these numbers are very concerning. Again, you know, I talk about there have never been as many self-help books and coaches and therapists and movies and programs about mental health, and yet we are still in a very, very troubling and worrisome situation when it comes to American mental health. For example, anxiety disorders such as generalized anxiety disorder, obsessive compulsive disorder, panic disorders are some of the most commonly diagnosed mental health conditions in the United States, affecting 42.5 million adults, and post-traumatic stress disorder, real, real issues that people are needing real, really good help. If we're talking about bipolar disorder, affects approximately 5.7 million adults age 18 and over. This is according to the National Institute of Mental Health. And then we get down to, you know, my very, very concerning, and my husband might say obsessive area that I spent so many years researching and treating, you know, really thousands of people when it comes to relationship issues. And here we have again, with all the talk about relationships and the programs and the shows, here we have that 3 women every single day in the United States are killed as a result of domestic violence. Again, not blaming the women, but we have to think about what to do, what to do. Every 9 seconds in the United States, a woman is assaulted or beaten by her, in quotes, significant other. One in 10 high school students experience physical and or sexual dating violence, which is why it is so important that we focus a great deal in the schools on mental health and, of course, relationship education. And what's interesting, too, I mean, the kids now, they graduate from high school, they're on their way to college. Hopefully they've had some relationship education in high school, if they're lucky. And what we're seeing, however, is 43% of college co-eds allege physical or sexual abuse by their dating partner. And only 33% of teens who were in an abusive relationship ever told anyone about the abuse. And this is an interesting number, that 81% of parents believe that teen dating violence is not an issue. It is not an issue. And this is where I go on and on and on about the important role that our schools have. I mean, when you think about it, our children spend most of their days in school, right? You know, other than during the summer vacation and, you know, other breaks that they have throughout the year. So we have an incredible opportunity. Teachers, guidance counselors, social workers, and psychologists, we are in an amazingly unique position to identify students who are grappling with a variety of mental health and social issues. And what this does, if we're there, if we have the resources, if we care, if we have the awareness, and I think it really does come down to caring, this enables the resources within the school to intervene as early as possible when issues begin to surface, even at the first grade level. And I look back years and years ago, after I finished my graduate and postgraduate work at McGill, I began, my first job was in the inner city schools of Montreal. And it was great. The schools, the guidance counselors, the psychologists, the principals, the vice principals, we were committed. We were committed in schools in the Greater Montreal area to early identification and early intervention. And when I began in the elementary school area. And the little kids, they were 6, they were 7, they were 8, perhaps they were acting out, perhaps they were, in quotes, too shy, they were having a variety of different kinds of issues, perhaps with their peers. But the teachers were so involved and concerned to make sure that these children, that they were not just having a bad day, but that perhaps there was something else going on that needed to be looked at. And if we were concerned with these little kids, the parents would come in, and I remember making home visits to make sure that we as educators, that we as professionals were in fact doing what was in the best interest of our students. And as my career in the school social work world really changed, I became one of the directors of the entire Montreal School Social Services program. And I saw firsthand, and am convinced that if school administrators and parents and the community at large were genuinely interested and committed to our children, our students' emotional and psychological well-being, that we would easily be able to find sufficient resources, money, that would be the really a determining factor in making an incredible difference in terms of how well or how badly our children were going to do. Because we're looking at data. We're looking at crisis data about our children. For example, the Department of Disease Control, and this is current data, reported that between 2011 and 2021, the number of teens and young adults with clinical depression more than doubled. So we're talking 2011, 2021. And that the suicide rate, and this number as a mom completely freaks me out, that the suicide rate for children between the ages of 10 to 14, yes, 10 to 14 tripled and nearly quadrupled for girls. So what is going on with our kids, our little kids who are ages 10 to 14? And again, there are always signs, or maybe not always, but if you look carefully, particularly if you are a teacher, or if you are a parent, you are going to be able to see on an ongoing basis that something is off. And I have always felt I would rather err on the side of caution. And I'm not talking about putting everybody into therapy and diagnosing people. It's not about that at all, but it is making sure, given these statistics, I mean, these statistics are not made up statistics. When we're talking about suicide rates for 10 to 14-year-old children, that they tripled and nearly quadrupled for girls, we have a serious problem. And this is another number. I was writing my Ask BD advice column for Dan's papers yesterday, and this number really, really is a very concerning number as well. And it's nearly 25% of teenage girls, and listen to this, 25% of teenage girls made a suicide plan in 2021. A quarter of our teenage girls are wanting to die. What is it that is going on? And again, if we really care about all of this, we are going to have to put our heads together. We are going to have to find the resources, the money, and the human resources to really implement programs. And I believe beginning in the schools. I mean, you think about it, it is the most logical place in the world. We see the kids day in and day out. And as important as it is that they achieve academically, if they are not in a good place in terms of their mental and emotional health, you can imagine and you can see what the impact is going to be on academics. I don't want to depress you, but I do have to cite some more grim news here. Now, in 2022, the Surgeon General, Vivek Murthy, issued a nationwide advisory on protecting youth mental health. His response came on the heels of the American Academy of Pediatrics. So these are very, very well recognized institutions. So they declared a state of emergency in child and adolescent mental health. So we're talking 2022. It is now the post-pandemic, and this is what is going on. And Murthy's address included data of how poorly American children were doing before the pandemic. Because I think it's really easy. You know, we're trying to figure out cause and effect. And I think that, you know, it's easy to be able to, you know, point fingers at the impact that the pandemic had on all of us. People are working from home. There's less person-to-person connection. There's loneliness. But what this address and the data are showing us is that our children were doing poorly before the pandemic. More statistics here. And I want you, you know, maybe you're going to want to get involved in some way. Maybe you have children or grandchildren. You're thinking, you know what? Perhaps I should just go to the school and schedule a meeting with the teachers or the principals or the administrators and talk about the kinds of programming that they have. And more importantly, if need be, more and better programming that actually should be implemented into the schools. So we can be very, we can take a very proactive approach in all of this, even if it hasn't touched us personally. 1 in 5 American children between the ages, and this number really, it's incredible, between the ages of 3 and 17 had a mental, emotional, developmental, or behavioral disorder. Over the last 10 years, the number of high school students, again, reporting persistent feelings of sadness or hopelessness increased by 40%, and suicide rates amongst American children aged 10 to 24 increased by 57% between the years of 2002 and 2018. So we are not in a position where we can bury our heads in the sand. There is a real crisis. And I know that there have been multiple articles in journals and certainly in the New York Times. But the real question is, what are we going to do about it? Are we going to continue week in and week out to cite these extremely concerning and upsetting statistics, or are we going to lobby our schools, lobby our administrators, become involved as parents, as citizens, and really force, if at all possible, and I'm talking about violence, of course, I'm not talking about forcing people to do anything, but, you know, with the use of violence, but really forcing administrators and legislators to wake up. And I don't want to hear any schools or any teachers or any administrators talk about the fact that there aren't resources, that there is not sufficient money. There is sufficient money if one actually cares. And this actually takes me back to 2007, I believe. I was living in Sarasota, Florida. My book, For Better, For Worse, Forever, Discover the Path to Lasting Love, had been out for a number of years. I had regular Ask Beattie segments on the ABC New News. And one day I got a call from Governor Bush. And it was really an interesting call. He called me personally, and I am a registered Democrat. And it was like, okay, what does Governor Bush possibly want from me? Well, what happened was that he appointed me to the Florida State Commission on Marriage and Family Support initiatives for the sole purpose, or at least I thought it was going to be the sole purpose, of implementing my relationship education program into the high schools and into the colleges. And I was really excited, very, very naive politically. I had never been involved in politics, so this was my first political appointment. Very excited. And for 2 years, I had an opportunity to meet with all of the decision makers, the education people, the social service people in the state of Florida. I'd be taking planes and getting in my car when it was not too, you know, far to drive, talking up the program, looking at the issues, talking about divorce, talking about domestic violence and teenage and co-ed dating abuse. And I naively thought that people really cared about all of this. So after 2 years, it became very, very, very clear to me that this was an exercise. It was an interesting exercise for me, but it was really an exercise in futility. And why am I saying that? Because what was really clear to me was that nobody really cared at all about the issues. And I have to say that the teachers did, but they had no power and they had no money. And we didn't get involved in teachers' unions or anything like that. And that was the end of that. And I made a big fuss because I was really, really hoping and I was thinking that this could have made a huge difference, you know, to have had programs in the schools where the children would have a real opportunity to learn about healthy relationships, to learn about the ingredients that go into a healthy relationships. And of course, you know, using my formula to help them learn to assess who is right for you and who's wrong for you before committing to any serious relationship. But it did not happen. It did not happen. And I think I was the only commissioner on this particular commission who was not reappointed. And because I was very vocal about all of this, I thought that it was serious business. I thought it was serious business, but it was not serious business at all. So that doesn't mean that we give up. It means that every single day we have an opportunity to at least to try to do something that would make a difference in terms of our children's mental health, in terms of our children and also our adults' lack of knowledge when it comes to relationship education. But in doing my column, in writing the column yesterday, and my editor, my husband, Jim, who was just amazing and patient, I think that if people have ever written books or if they've written articles, you really do need to have a terrific editor to be able to just edit and make necessary changes so that things are going to read better. So yesterday, when I was drafting my article, I happened to read about concerns in studies about the connection between the use of social media and some of the mental health issues that our children, and I would think not just our kids, the adults as well, but this was focused on children. So, research psychologist, and her name is Jean Twenge. She is the author of books iGen and Generations, and she has spent years poring over mental health statistics and the data, trying to answer the question whether or not there is a connection between the use of social media and mental health issues. Now, this is what she concluded. She concludes that the data is clear, according to research psychologist Jean Twenge. And this is what she says. She says, our teenage mental health crisis, this is her view, is the direct product of the rise of smartphones and social media. And these are some of the statistics, and I'm sure that it's not the only issue that is affecting our children's mental health, but these are her findings, and I'm just reporting what she has said. 48% of teens say that they go online several times a day. 48% of teenage girls say that they are online almost constantly, which reminded me to put away my phone. 43% of teenage boys say that they are online almost constantly as well. So on average, now listen to this number. On average, teenagers spend around 7 hours and 22 minutes per day on the phone. So let me ask you a personal question, my friends. How much time? How much time do you actually spend on your devices? Are you spending as much as these kids? I mean, hopefully you're not. And yet you look around. I mean, wherever we go, people are on their phones. I mean, I used to suggest to patients all the time, go to the gym or go out and say hello and try and connect and meet some people. Nowadays, you'll go to a gym or you'll go to a restaurant, and what do you see? People are on their phones. They're not looking. They're not seemingly want to interact. And it certainly has created a lot of problems. I mean, mental health issues, and I believe has certainly contributed to the loneliness epidemic that researchers have also been talking about more and more. So you may be curious, as I was, about how social media works on the brain. Well, some researchers have argued that social media platforms, that they drive surges of dopamine, we know what dopamine is, to the brain, which keep consumers coming back over and over again, much as a drug that people can become addicted to. It's very, very seductive. The stimulation can involve a constant concern. And I'm sure that many of you can relate to this with how many followers, how many likes we have today or this minute or this hour. So you want to be really honest with yourself. Are you as immersed in this as these studies are really demonstrating? Impressionable young females became obsessive about whether they look as hot as some of the other girls in the videos that they are watching. Should I make a new and better one? I mean, many of them wonder. So it's the shares, the likes, and the comments on these platforms that trigger the brain's reward center, resulting in a high similar to the one that people may feel when gambling or using drugs. You're getting all this response. It's so stimulating. It's so high. It feels so good. It is euphoric. But the highs, yes, is very much the case that even though the highs feel great, and it is, it's intoxicating. But what happens? What happens when you're not getting the hope for responses or likes, where nobody is responding to you? In fact, this reminds me of a patient that I'm treating right now. He is 25 years old. He has had a lot of social issues. He just has not really been able to connect with people socially, really other than his immediate family. So at 25, and he's never had a date, and he told me that he would really like to socialize, despite the fact that everybody is plugged in. So what happened was I helped him put together a profile, and with the pictures, and he's great. He's nice, a little awkward, but a really, really good guy. So his profile has been up now. It's probably about a month, and he hasn't gotten any response at all. No likes, no comments, no nothing. And, you know, he's getting, of course, very, very discouraged. So we're going to have to take a look at it. In fact, I'm going to be seeing him tonight, you know, what can we do so that there will hopefully be some response to his profile? So this is the thing. When you're not getting the hoped for responses or likes, or where your online profile or comments or images are being ridiculed or ignored, and you see this a lot with the kids, you start to wonder, right? And understandably so, what's wrong with me? Am I not smart enough? Are pretty enough? And without a clear and rational perspective about the ups and downs, and of course, that's not just for kids and teens, but without a rational perspective about the ups and downs and the inconsistencies and absurdity, because it is really absurd, of social media, many teens find that their moods begin to rise and plummet, which can result in feelings of depression, self-doubt, self-hate, and even contemplating and possibly thinking about committing suicide. So social media, it's not the whole story. But since people are plugged in and are looking, they are looking for this kind of connection and positive reinforcement from their devices. If they are not getting it, you can understand how the feelings of depression and self-doubt and self-hate can really come about. But as you know, listening to me for all these years, for me, it's what to do. So what can parents do? Well, I think that you can work with your teen to manage their screen time. And there may be a lot of ups and downs and they don't want you involved, but I think as parents, we have a responsibility to say no and to manage our children's screen time. And like any behavior that can become addictive, a gradual lessening of time spent viewing social media needs to begin with a one day at a time goal. And you may get a lot of resistance, you know, from your kids, but remember, you are the parent. Communicate with your teen to help them understand and respect the healthy boundaries in their relationship with social media. And I think that, again, we as parents, we need to show them how it can be used for enjoyment or information, but not just pure escapism and distraction. And there's a huge difference. I think it's great. We can go and we can Google and we can get all kinds of information. However, what I have seen and what I have found, it is very, very easy to be using social media as a way of escaping what's going on in your day-to-day life and as a distraction. So what else can you do, parents? Well, you can agree on long-term goals and strategies to help your teen sustain a healthy relationship with social media. Yeah, you need to talk about all of this with your kids and explain to your teen. And this is going to be a tough one, especially since the younger generation, and I think also the older generation, we are so caught up with the immediate response of likes and followers. So we need to do a better job, adults and parents, in terms of explaining to our teens that likes and followers do not and should not define the totality of who we are. And these are conversations that we need to have with our children. And make sure, and it's very easy for us to become, you know, the know-it-alls when it comes to our kids, but we should try very hard not to, because they will tune us out Absolutely, for sure. So make sure that these conversations are meaningful and empathic. We need to listen to them. Don't speak down to them. Listen to their feelings, their worries, their insecurities about fitting in. And finally, because I was thinking, you know, what to do? Everybody seems to be on their phone. People are still working from home. But I think it's so important that we encourage our children, our teens, to cultivate person-to-person friendships and activities, including things like sleepovers, in-person partnering with homework assignments. You know, I tell them, bring over your friend, you know, I'll give you some milk and cookies. And maybe now that the weather is a little bit nice, you can sit out in the backyard and you can partner together with your homework assignments. And also team sports. What a great, great way for connection, which forces everybody to get off their devices. It's great for the body. It's great for the soul. It's great for socialization. It's great. I can't think of there's no negative at all when it comes to the benefits of team sports. And also, you know, we need to continue to encourage person-to-person meetups. We've gotten into this mode. I mean, I can't even believe what I'm just about to tell you. But I have patients here in New York City who live a couple of blocks away from me. I have one woman who lives one block away, and yet she refuses to come in for in-person therapy. So we do this FaceTime, and it has nothing to do with the pandemic at all. So we've gotten used to doing a variety of different things. Of course, it's not just, you know, being on our devices that are really not in our best interest and that have a major, major negative impact on how we feel. And also, you know, think about, even if you're not religious, that there are many synagogues and churches and clubs and organizations that have youth groups where teens can participate in a variety of, again, in-person programs. And my bias is that the more face-to-face in-person connections, the better. By the way, one of my readers who reads my Ask Beauty Advice column in Dan's paper, she sent me an email. She loves the column, etc. But what she said that was, I felt, really important is that there, for people who are living in New York, New York State, there is now a national 24/7 hotline for suicide prevention and other depression. And the number is 988. Apparently, a New York group lobbied for this for years, and it has just launched not more than 3 months ago. So thank you, thank you, thank you for letting me know about that. And again, the number, it's called the 988 Lifeline. So if you know anybody, or if you yourself are feeling suicidal or extremely depressed and you don't have anybody in your, you know, personal circle to talk to, again, this crisis number is 988. You know, I would love so much, you know, to be able to hear what your thoughts are, what your feelings are on what I've really just presented. It's scary. You know, again, with all the self-help talk and books and shows and therapists, you know, I'm looking at another article here. Suicide rates rose again in 2021 following a two-year decline. Two-year decline in yearly suicide ended in 2021. The suicide rates rose again among younger Americans and people of color, according to a new report from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
And I found this to be interesting and very concerning, that for decades, suicide rates among Black and Hispanic Americans were comparatively low, around a third the rates recorded among white Americans. But a gradual shift, unfortunately, is underway as suicide rates rise in populations that have been most affected by the pandemic. You know, the loneliness that so many people are feeling, and researchers have defined it as a loneliness epidemic, because Americans, perhaps the pandemic triggered a lot of this. I'm not so sure that it caused it, but certainly triggered, a state where we were not able to get together with people on a regular basis. And Americans have indeed become increasingly lonely and isolated. And it's this lack of social connection, again, is having profound effects on our mental and physical well-being. And I think that there are things that we actually can do.
I know that I find, if I'm feeling a little down, a little out of sorts, just getting out and saying hello to strangers. There was a piece in the New York Times a couple of weeks ago. The headline was, they know your face, maybe not your name. And it's this chit-chat, this really informal chit-chat. How are you? It's a beautiful day. It does really positive things for our feelings of and our needs for some kind of connection. And this is something that I think that we all have to take, you know, really, really seriously. And also, when people call, you know how sometimes you just don't want to pick up the phone, you're in a bad mood, you're depressed, you're feeling lonely. Well, again, studies and researchers and people like myself are saying, when people call, pick up the phone, pick up the phone. And even if it's only for 10 seconds, even if it's only you have a little bit of human connection, that can really make a difference. And what about volunteering, you know, in serving others and having a purpose? We get back, I believe, so much more than the people who we are serving. So consider donating your time to an organization in your community, or offering to help your family or coworkers or friends, because it's true. When we help other people, we establish an experience or a connection with them, but we also remind ourselves of the value that we bring to the world, which makes us feel better about ourselves, which makes us feel a lot less lonely. And that's essential, because when people struggle with loneliness over time, it erodes our self-esteem and our sense of self. And it can make them believe over time that they're lonely because they're not likable or they're not lovable. But if you're finding it, despite all of the research and all of the suggestions and all of the self-help books, that you're continuing to just kind of go around in circles, and you're depressed and you're anxious and you're disconnected, and maybe you're suicidal, and you're just not on the track that you would like to be, again, I really, really hope that you take my message that I have been, you know, really getting out for all these years of reaching out and asking for help. And yes, trying to negotiate fees. And even if you have to be on a waiting list to get into a social service organization, that you give yourself permission to do what is in your best interest, because none of us can navigate life's ups and downs on our own. Well, I can't believe that it is 3:54 here in beautiful, sunny New York City. I had so many things. I wanted to talk about how to find a therapist, and that all therapists are definitely not the same. But I want to leave you with my two weekly messages. And the first, of course, and this is really apropos of everything that I've been talking about today,
to do whatever you need to do in terms of your mental health, your physical health, getting enough sleep, having enough connections, where you are living your life in ways that are really in your best interest. And this is where I ask patients, and I ask myself as well every single day, to evaluate, am I being good to myself? Am I doing the things that I need to do that are really in my best interest? Exercise, weight training, if you're into meditation and yoga, making sure that you're getting enough sleep, that you have supportive people in your life, that you eliminate toxins of every kind, chemical toxins, and also people toxins, including family and friends. So that there are many, many things that we can do every single day, including helping others and giving back and redefining our purpose, or getting a dog, which of course is wonderful, wonderful company, or joining a support group to do things that will help us get through the tough times that we all experience in our life. And then secondly, of course, think about this. We all need to do a much, 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 much better job in learning to love each other, understand each other, respect each other, despite our differences, our political differences, our religious differences. There's so many things that we can do to bring people together rather than to keep people apart. And it makes all the difference in the world, in politically and community-wise, when we are able to relate and connect with other people who are maybe very, very different from ourselves in all kinds of ways. But those connections are valuable, and we can learn. We can learn from others despite our political beliefs and despite our differences. So I think that we need to be open. We need to be open to the possibilities of connecting in all kinds of ways with people who we normally never would have thought about, or maybe never even wanted to connect with. So those are my messages, and I hope that you are going to have a really wonderful rest of the day. And I would really appreciate your feedback, emails. You can go to my bdco.com website. I'd love to hear from you. I would love to hear whether any of this at all that I talk about every single week is having a positive impact. And if it's having a negative impact, I would like to hear about that as well. So again, everybody, I wish you a beautiful rest of the day and week, and I will talk with you next week and every week, every Monday from 3 to 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, right here on the Ask BD Show on the Progressive Radio Network. So take care, love yourself, and let's do a better job in loving each other. Bye-bye.